Hi, Rachel. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, you know me. I'm forever evolving as we talk.
What?
I'm feeling fine and dandy now, but maybe by the end of the episode, supreme existentialism and nihilism will just set in and I'll feel drained. But for the moment, I'm feeling like prey.
Oh, but once you've evolved, you'll get over it within a few minutes.
Oh, I evolve. I'm evolving. You're evolving. Evolution is here on the pod. We're no longer the Yum Yum pod. We're the Evolution pod because evolution is what this show is about.
Yep. So move over, Nan. We've replaced your particular piece of iconic dialogue
with some galaxy pie.
Galaxy pie, it is.
It's like this delicious slice of galaxy pie.
We're all having a fun time because we're talking about a really fun show that nobody gets cranky about, no one gets cynical about, no one gets nihilistic about.
Everyone's on the same page. Opinions on.
Everyone has clear, concise opinions that are unified. We all agree. Everything's hunky-dory out there when it comes to the modern landscape of Star Trek, especially Star Trek Discovery, and especially...
the quality of highness.
Especially Season 2, which is what we are rewatching currently.
Oh, boy.
So if you have not seen Season 2 of Star Trek Discovery, we're going to be spoiling Season 2. We're not going to really touch on Season 3 that much. Mm. I will only touch on it a little bit, but not necessarily any plot points, just kind of character things. Because this episode that we are revisiting, because this is our first time...
Season 2, Episode 6.
This is our first time rewatching it.
Yeah.
It is our first time seeing this episode again since it initially aired. So this is, as you just said, Rachel, episode 6 of season 2, The Sound of Thunder.
Boom!
This is a very character-centric episode. This is a Saru episode.
Yes.
But let's hear how IMDb describes this episode. When a new signal appears over Saru's home planet, Burnham, Saru, and the crew embark on a perilous mission that puts Saru in danger and raises questions about the Red Angel's intentions. Hugh comes to struggle to terms with his new reality. I love IMDb's descriptions because that made it sound like Hugh had a plot. This episode. Here's how I could do this. If I was the IMDb writers, I could also do this. So instead of saying Hugh struggles with his new reality or whatever, I could also put in Tilly discovers some amazing pieces of information from the spore, sphere information, or Arium is tirelessly researching the sphere data and finds some startling revelations. See how that is all in the episode. All these things are in the episode, but if you put it in the description, it makes it sound like that's actually a plot. But it's not actually a plot. But we'll get into that in the Hugh die, won't we, Hugh? Yes, we will, darling. So, Rachel, this is Season 2, Episode 6, The Sound of Thunder. The perilous, the amazing, the delicious, the very spiritual and faithful story about how Saru's people, the Kelpians, are free of their evil oppressors, the Ba'ul, and they evolve into their true form, people who shoot darts out of their heads. And have no sense of fear anymore because they can now shoot darts out of their heads. That's what Saru's been... That's what his character arc's been going towards. Dart head. I'm sorry. It's really funny to think that in season one, when they set up this whole thing about his ganglia and about how he's driven by fear and he can sense death, that in his species, in the real world of his species, that's just like a minor footnote. That's like when babies grow teeth for the first time, that's like teething for them. And when their teeth fall and they get new teeth, like it's just really funny that the really interesting, cool setup and foundation for Saru's character and his entire being and his race of people is just like this silly little footnote, really, because at the end of the day, their true form is that they no longer feel the sense of death around them or fear or any of that, or can sense things, it's that they can shoot darts out of their heads.
With the loss of your threat ganglia, the cartilage that housed it is reorganizing to accommodate a new type of keratin-based tissue. It looks like spikes growing in like teeth.
Rachel, how did you feel about this episode when it initially aired?
I did not particularly enjoy it. I found it confusing, which I still kind of did, but that is because I thought about things that I wasn't supposed to think about.
Oh, really?
Yes.
wait, when you first saw it or this time around?
Both.
Okay. When we watched it this time around, were you thinking of the things that I brought up in a previous episode about his whole entire race and species that you didn't think about before?
Yeah.
We'll get into that. So I liked this episode when it first aired. It was one of my highlights of the season. I knew, like one of the previous episodes, New Eden, that things would get called into question on the rewatch factor. Same with the sphere data one. Like the ones that I enjoyed the first time round, I knew they would get called into question on the rewatch because, as stated, this isn't just a show. You can't judge it episode by episode. It's a part of a larger narrative. Each episode's just a chapter in a book, and you don't judge a book by chapter, even though if you don't like the chapters thus far, you stop reading the fucking book. But hey, judge the whole picture. Now that I've seen the whole picture, and I go back to these episodes, there's trepidation there, as there is for you. You were already negative on some of these from the beginning. I was a little bit more hopeful. I enjoyed them. This was one I enjoyed, and I knew going back there would be a weird place there because where they take Saru's character from this whole story beat and the Kelpians and how they're incorporated in the last episode and what this does with the whole Kelpian setup and how it kind of just resets the board with them. I don't like any of that. So when I come back to the episode, that's the reason all the stuff that I don't like when it comes to Saru and his people is here. I didn't like it, but at the same time, Rachel, I did enjoy myself on this watching. There were things that I really did enjoy. I was feeling the momentum of the episode, but then by the end, it kind of just kept going, and it felt like this episode was like 10 minutes too long to me. It felt like, okay, can we wrap this up? Like,
I think it's more like, you know, about 44, 43 minutes too long.
But yes, it's a mixed bag experience for me on this watch. Mm-hmm. I had things I really did enjoy about it and things that I really didn't enjoy about it.
Okay, well, how about we start with the positives then? What do you give this episode kudos for?
Saru, Doug Jones's performance for 80% of it is really great. Like top tier, top notch.
I agree.
Excellent. 80%. There's
80%,
like 20% of his stuff in here is stinking garbage and he's not very good at.
I feel
anger.
Like the opening monologue is an accurate reflection of that and sets up the kind of wave that you ride with Doug Jones's performance and Saru's character journey of being like, yeah, this is good. Oh, no.
What was a positive that you got from the episode? What was something that you enjoyed?
I enjoy the, like, CG designs of Kaminar. I like the way that the planet looks and that their entire world is made up of villages. There's no cities.
You like the plant life and the water and the color palettes of the sky.
Yeah, and the way that they've set up the world as being very peaceful and
it's paradise.
In balance. If they weren't being subjugated, it would be
a paradise.
Utopian. And I really do appreciate the design that went into those things, including the flowers that are part of Saru's quarters, the garden that he's developed.
Yeah.
I think it's a really nice touch.
Mm-hmm.
And it adds it adds more meaning when we do go to the planet and we see all of those elements
yes.
in abundance. bits. I enjoy that.
It makes the Ba'ul stuff really great too, aesthetically, because they're the exact opposite. Yes. They're very, you know, technology-wise, of course, they're far ahead, but their technology, the architecture and the design of it is very cold, very rigid, these harsh lines and you know, no curves, just blocks of things and pointed and jagged looking, and they're just hovering there, reminding you that the peaceful, you know, village aesthetic has this imposing thing in the middle of each one of them. And the aesthetic for the Kelpians, their villages, their planet, their nature, has to work for that to work as well, to have the juxtaposition there, because they could have had it, oh, their slave race, right? They could have had it like how the future is being shown in season 3, where everything's kind of like your typical post-apocalyptic, degraded kind of old west, or like, you know what I'm talking about? That kind of really crappy. But this is like, go back to the biblical stuff, a Garden of Eden aesthetic. But then you have this cold, harsh, metallic object there reminding you of the sinister nature that's actually going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like you cannot avoid being reminded of the power structure that's been constructed between the two species.
The watchful eye.
The watchful eye is always there. And I think on this viewing, I understood the perspective of the Ba'ul a little bit more, and I appreciated the way that they tried to explain why the Ba'ul has this opinion beyond them just being like, evil. We want to be in power.
Yeah.
I was just like, okay, well, yeah, I get it. And then they still went for the genocide. So I was like,
That's another positive, not genocide. That's a negative. No, a positive I have is the Ba'ul. I love the Ba'ul. I love almost everything about them. There's one little niggling thing I have that I do not like, but that's something we'll get into later. I love the look of the Ba'ul. I love the sound of the Ba'ul. I love their ships. I love their architecture. I love the way that the episode itself, outside of the little short trek we've seen and what Saru has or hasn't said about them, just the episode shows us how fucking terrifying they are. Like, when they have to teleport out because the Ba'ul are coming, and you just see that light coming over and you hear all this rumbling going on and you get the atmosphere there, everyone's freaking out. Great atmosphere and tension with the Ba'ul, and I love what they look like. I love it because I grew up with Star Trek Next Generation, and there was a shitty muckman oil monster guy that killed Tasha Yar, and that guy fucking sucked, design-wise and character-wise. And it was nice to see that Star Trek Discovery is finally using its budget and its CG to actually come up with an interesting monster character design that is an improvement on things that we have seen in the past, because the Muckman guy, I don't even remember what fucking race he is. I know he's not a Ba'ul, right? I know that. But it's the idea of, in Star Trek, we've seen a famous Muckman guy before. He's a very famous guy because he killed Tasha Yar in the most pathetic way we've ever seen a character get killed before. Just gently smacked her.
That does happen. That is a thing.
And the people always make fun of that Muckman design, and I've always thought you could do something cool with that. And Star Trek Discovery actually did something, in my opinion, cool with a design that was lackluster in the past. They actually saw it and said, I don't know if they actually saw it, but there's in my brain, they saw this thing, it didn't work, let's elevate it and make it into something new and interesting. Yeah, and each little facet of their physical demeanor, like the little spikes growing out of their backs and all these weird alien things that they kept having on there.
The drip effect. The
drip effect, and the way that their fingers would kind of detract in on themselves. Just every little physical thing of the acting and the CG work, I liked it. It was creepy. Their eyes, their voice. I like the Ba'ul, and I like them as antagonistic figures and how they've set up the dynamic between them and the Kelpians. It made sense to me how that they could subjugate these people and these people without actually having to interact with them very much.
No.
It's very much secondhand of, we just have these pillars here and let the Kelpians work a religion around it.
Oppressive presence, so they don't need to be physically present.
Yeah, time they just kind of let the Kelpians form a religion around their oppression, and thus it's no longer oppression anymore, but faith, which is one of the few times, here's another positive, one of the few times I actually think Star Trek Discovery has a slight nuance in terms of talking about faith, because we talked about on one of our Patreon episodes that you can check out, we talked about on our Babylon 5 Patreon that one of the things that Babylon 5 does really well with faith and spirituality is it shows multiple aspects of that, including the negatives, including the toxic and the harsh elements. And this episode's doing that really well. It shows you how the faith can be weaponized and used against people. And I really like that about this episode. What else did you find to be positive in this one? Because you're a little bit more negative, so it's always good to hear.
I am. And I think I didn't enjoy the Ba'ul's design as much on the first viewing, because I had more trouble distinguishing the black on the black background.
Yeah.
Which I still found a little bit frustrating, but less so on this watch. Mm-hmm. I think it's because I knew what they looked like more, so I could kind of tell better.
You knew what to expect.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, yeah, that's the sleek part, because a part of the design is that they blend into their environment in some ways, and they are organic, like part of it, because like they come up from
From the goo. They're in a vat of goo.
Yeah.
Wherever that leads, I don't know, but
yeah, we don't get the details on that, which I like that we aren't over-explained as to what the Ba'ul are and how they work.
And they wait for the money shot of showing you the full shot of what they look like properly. Mm-hmm. They actually waited. They gave you close-ups. They gave you behind-the-shoulder shots. They gave you, like, little
builds the atmosphere and the tension in a way where it feels...
They didn't blow their load.
Yeah. It feels paced rather than on fast forward.
It wasn't like, look at our cool special effect that we made. They actually waited for that moment to show you that cool special effect that they made. Which, restraint? Fucking hell, I'm not used to it. What was another strength of the episode for you, though? Anything outside of the Ba'ul? Because a lot of our stuff goes back to Kamina, but anything happening with our crew on Discovery, or Discovery itself, or the Red Angel, or is it just really the Ba'ul and Kamina is the positives of this episode, and Saru's performance and characterization for the most part?
Pike is still solid.
He's right. Throughout the whole episode, he's just correct, and they should just let him do his job.
Yeah, like, if everybody listened to Pike, everything kind of would have been fine.
Yeah, yeah, I think it would have worked itself out in somewhat of a reasonable fashion.
Like, if everybody listened to Pike, we wouldn't have the setup for the Kelpians to return in the final battle, necessarily.
Can we not mention that stupid final battle in the second at the end of the second season? It's so dumb and stupid, and I hate it.
You have learned to pilot a fighter.
I did enjoy that the Ba'ul were totally just unfazed by Pike, and that they were not going to listen to him. These were one of those villains in which it made sense that their only option to win was genocide. It made sense to me. With the way that they explained them and the way that we got shown their structure, it made 100% sense that their end game would just be kill all of them. And it was totally believable to me that they did not back down from that perspective. And we could complain about that in other episodes, but this one, it made sense to me. Another thing that I also really did enjoy, and this one is a bit more of a shaky ground to stand on to say I like, because it's also something that I will
complain about later,
will argue against, but
okay.
There was a sense of focus in this episode. It didn't feel like I was rushing towards all these other characters' fucking storylines. It felt like I was following Saru's story, even though we had stuff with Hugh, we had stuff with Paul, we had a thesis statement. There was an energy that it was focusing on the situation on Kamina, and everything around that outside of Hugh was focusing on the situation with Kamina. Arium and Tilly, they helped focus in on the story on Kamina.
Hugh's storyline does thematically match Saru's.
But it means that we know who we'll talk about it with Hugh now, but that indicates that we care about Hugh as a character a lot.
Yeah, it does.
Do you... Like, I feel shaky on that because there's things I'll argue against that, but I did enjoy there was a sense of focus. It did feel like, okay, this is Saru's episode. It didn't feel like it got hijacked by Michael. And this is where my other positive comes in that may be shaky and you'll disagree with me. Outside of the very end of the episode in which Michael hijacks the end of the episode and says, it's about me again, by the way. I enjoyed Michael in this episode for the most part, because she served her role like she did in New Eden, which was, it wasn't all about her.
She was just a xenoanthropologist.
Oh, remember that? She's a xenoanthropologist, guys, and she studied quantum mechanics. I enjoyed Michael a lot more in this episode because she wasn't the central focus. I think Michael could work as a character, but when we're focusing in on her the whole time for episodes and seasons, she falls weak to me. And in this episode, she worked for me because she was offering something to Saru, not taking it from him, like she did in the Blue Planet episode, where I felt like she took his episode away from him. This one, I felt like she was helping him on his journey in the episode as the protagonist of this story. And I liked that. I think that they need to accept that Michael can do that sometimes, and they should embrace that she should do that more often. And
the protagonist doesn't have to be the main character in every storyline.
Yeah, and with a Star Trek show, the protagonist can be different people any episode. And I know this isn't like old Star Trek, it's not episodic anymore, but DS9 managed to do that, and that was far more serialized than normal than TNG or the original series.
All of these things could be done well and have been done well in either Star Trek shows or other shows.
Exactly. Like Babylon 5 is a pretty serialized story. Of course, there's still one-offs. It still has some episodic stuff, but that one's like, as many people say, Star Trek Discovery is for some reason, but this one is more so. Babylon 5 is very much like a book. A giant book. But that show isn't afraid to also just go, hey, Sinclair, hold back for a bit. This is a Delenn episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that about this episode.
Laying out the idea rather than skipping ahead to the goal.
I also liked that Saru used their technology against them again. That was a nice reincorporation of the short trek, which I did not see originally, the short trek. So this was a bonus on the rewatch factor because now I had seen something that was set up before.
But they also do explain it
within
clearly.
This episode without it making me feel like I missed supplemental material. Yes, they do show flashbacks to that short trek in this episode, but when I first saw it, I didn't know that short trek existed. I thought they just shot things for this.
Short Tracks continues with The Brightest Star on December 6th on CBS All Access.
You said when you originally saw this, you didn't like it, you found it confusing.
Mm-hmm.
You still find it confusing, but in different ways.
Yes.
What was confusing about it the first time, and how has that cleared up in some ways now that you are rewatching it?
So I just got tripped up on minor details that don't really matter, but just affected the flow of the episode for me. Like, just the fact that the Bowel achieved warp 20 years ago.
Yes, I think that's what they said in the episode, yes.
But they do not set up a clear division of time between when the Baul achieved warp capabilities and Saru sending the transmission, because they say those things one thing after another. So I was just like, wait, why is Saru sent it 20 years ago? So what was he just not waiting to go home for those 2 years? And then I was like, oh no, wait, it just took him 2 years to do it. And that made more sense because we watched the short trek and we saw like that it took him quite some time to figure everything out after he found the piece.
Well, it took him some time to wait for just a random piece to fall off, as they often do.
Whatever.
You got hung up on the misunderstanding.
On the timeline of things, and then I was just like, on the first rewatch, I didn't fully understand the timeline of things because I was like, wait, how can they tell specifically which
species?
I understand that Discovery knows it fucking everything because
the sphere data. Sphere data.
I'm like, okay, whatever. They do that with everything now. They just know all. Galaxy pie is there. It's fine. So they eat that piece of galaxy pie and everything's explained away. But I was just like, how does the prey, who assumably is on the brink of extinction, they wouldn't have the technology that they do now to like specifically scan and see who is past Varahi and who is not. So how did they so quickly manage to wipe out all of these Kelpians from the, like, they're on the brink of extinction? How do they manage to just kill all of them? And Discovery, the data suggests that it happened like overnight.
They don't want you to think about that. It could have been an interesting question to actually explore and answer, because I think that you could make an answer for it, but they don't make one.
How did they fight their way back from extinction?
Well, how did they fight their way from nearly mass extinction to being the superior race? They say that they wiped out all of the ones with the Vahari, and then they left the ones that were unevolved, thus making the gene pool kind of, you know, less strong because eugenics. And that's why Saru's people don't get this until they're his dad's age, which is an elderly, elderly old man, in which it wouldn't matter that you have it, because you shoot a dart out of your head, you would break your hip doing it, probably.
Yeah, we know that, you know, koalas are on the brink of extinction, and in 20 years they'll be our overlords.
Of course! Well, because
it makes so much sense.
It makes sense because our government let the wildfires burn so brightly and kill nearly all the koalas, that the koalas are so mad now that they've got technology that we never knew about that kills us.
They're like the koala on the plane in The Simpsons.
On the helicopter? Yeah. That wasn't a joke, guys. The Simpsons was warning us of our future.
Well, that's what happens when you introduce foreign species into an ecosystem that can't handle them.
You make a great point. How did they know this? Now, how did they do this? They could have said they were the technological race, right, of the planet, and they found some piece of technology, let's say a bioweapon that wiped out the thing. They made their version of an atomic bomb, perhaps, that just wiped them out. This something, but they don't say it. So you just have to go, oh, I guess they just did. And that's
Varahi,
a bummer.
The Varahi, right, is set off for Saru and then like the rest of his planet by the sound. So if they just set up that the Baul figured out that this frequency attacked and overwhelmed the senses of those who were post Varahi.
Yeah, Varahi.
Varahi, and then killed then, but didn't affect the other people because they did. They didn't have those senses.
Oh,
that would make sense.
You know
what?
And you, oh my God, you know that actually. That is actually cool, of the idea of maybe they found a frequency that kills the Kelpians that have this. And you know what would have been cool? That's the weapons that they have the things in the villages be. Not just shoot lasers at them, but they make a noise of their own or something along that lines.
So then they can keep going with the balance. It's not a genocide. It's still a genocide, but it's not the complete mass extinction they're making.
Could be because they're making all Kelpians go through this thing.
But Michael says that it's only 63% and rising. It could potentially be like 1 or 2% of the population.
You're thinking that Discovery would stop making the sound?
Yeah, they wouldn't.
No,
but,
they wouldn't.
But we're talking about...
Get them with your head darts. But you're right. The thing is, this is a fair complaint because we were just praising, especially me, that they did a satisfying enough job with setting up what the Ba'ul are, what they are all about, how they managed to oppress them, but they just rushed through how they got to that place to begin with.
Never mind. That happened ages ago. We're worrying about now.
Nobody other than the Ba'ul.
Now, Ryan, we need to think about now. We need to save Serana and Saru and...
Head darts,
and we need to, you know, change the entire species, even though we were worrying about
Rachel,
the Prime Directive at the start of the episode. Now we're in for a penny, we're in for a pound. We need to change this entire planet.
You're right. And what bugs me is they always do this in Star Trek Discovery, which is time management issues. They have so many lines in which they just say nothing. And I feel like, how about if you, instead of wasting time with these meaningless lines, have lines that actually...
Have you got examples, Ryan?
Have lines that actually contribute to things like we're talking about. Because, look, you may not need to incorporate heavily in your story, but if you did have some lines of dialogue that went further into it, it would make the niggling feeling in our brains a little bit less so. But instead,
we would think that you cared just a little bit more.
Instead, you have to have the trailer dialogue such as, if we do this, everything will change. Or, you know, once this happens... This will be a new beginning. Those lines of dialogue are so trite and so overdone and such trailer dialogue. They don't offer anything, right? Those kind of lines don't offer anything other than, well, the composer made this piece of music and you have to have some line that matches this music.
Yeah.
So you have to have Saru say, everything will change. Why don't we cut these bullshit lines in which nothing's actually being said and actually have something that's actually being said? Because I've thought about this question about the Ba'ul, and honestly, give us a short trek about that and I would be a little bit more satisfied, because I've also wondered, how did the Ba'ul rise to power in that period of time? They just kind of rushed through it.
Yeah. So I had more of a problem with the dialogue in this episode that thought that it was being deep and philosophical.
Galaxy Pie.
Yeah, Galaxy Pie. So we have Saru chatting to Hugh. Would you like me to save that one for the during the Hudar or now?
We're going to have something for the Hudar.
Okay.
It's that and Scar talk. That's all we got for you.
Saru chatting with Serana and saying, I found a new life.
See, these are the kind of lines where they say the actors say them with this breathiness. And really, you don't need them, right? Just have characters talking.
I have never felt more clarity than in this moment. This is the only way.
I hate these. I hate this so much. And there's a ton of them. You're right. There's a ton of these trailer lines that really don't feel real. Because also, to go into that 20% of Doug Jones's performance, I've seen Doug Jones, let's say, act.
Mm-hmm.
Because I say, let's say, act, because most of the time he's not given lines of dialogue.
Yep.
He's usually a physical performer. Mm-hmm. Or if he is, he's not a main character. He's always a side character or an entity. Mm-hmm. So this is what's refreshing about seeing Star Trek Discovery, is we get to see Doug Jones actually get to act. Yes, he's still in all this prosthetics, but he's actually enveloping a character that we get to see from week to week to week, and see them develop and see them grow, see them change, see them interact with other people. There's this 20% in which Doug Jones, love him, but I haven't seen enough of his work, but he can't do anger.
Not
as Saru, at least. When Saru is angry and angsty and given his, I will not be oppressed. I'm sorry, it's awkward.
No,
it's very cringy.
It doesn't feel right.
Well, and that's the point, right? It's not supposed to feel right, because this is not how Saru is, but he's evolved, you see. So it is supposed to feel uncomfortable, because we know he's going to fuck up, but we know that Saru's not the type of character to fuck up, except for when he does. But my thing is, performance-wise, it feels stilted and awkward when Doug Jones is doing it, and I don't know if it's because I'm not used to Doug Jones externally being angry like how he was in this episode, or direction, but it was very awkward, and unfortunately it enters into the category of his characterization in the episode was poor in some parts, and the other part of the 20% is this talking that you're talking about. Like, there's moments in which him and his sister...
We will create a new Balin.
But there's actual moments where him and his sister have, like, conversations that feel like actual characters talking, but then it feels like for a moment there's a glitch in their brains and they talk like that. It's really distracting when it happens, because it's like,
you know this ancient Greek guy? Yeah, he was.
Oh, that was him and Michael,
tragedies.
Yeah.
And here's the start of the quote. I can finish that quote off
it's
for you, Michael.
It's just not natural. It feels like writers writing, which of course I've mentioned many times before, but I hate in shows like this or movies when you feel the writers just indulging themselves and just writing poetically for no real reason other than from a writer's perspective. Did you know Alice in Wonderland exists? Or did you know that ancient myths exist? It's very hackneyed and tired.
But Ryan, it's just a delicious slice of galaxy pie.
Galaxy pie.
I want to talk about Ash Tyler.
Tilly was a dumpster fire in this episode, and so was Ash Tyler.
Both were barely in it, so that really is a high praise of how bad they were. Let's talk Ash first.
Yep.
Ash is I'm just going to say it, like I kind of already said it, but I don't like that actor.
I do not like his performance style either.
He's whiny.
I think that it doesn't ring true for me a lot of the time, because, like, the script is saying one thing, but the performance
it's
doesn't
saying
quite
something else.
Yeah, so it doesn't mesh. So it feels like he's fighting against the script.
As someone who's studied acting and has done acting, I feel bad, because I can actually see the rationality behind what he's doing. I can see it. I understand it. I can understand it also with how they've structured his story. So, for instance, there's a scene near the end of the episode where him and Pike sit down and they have a conflicted conversation. Ash is debating him. Ash is pretty much Starfleeting him, saying, you're being blind to this, 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 and this. And, you know, he's being paranoid, as Pike calls it.
And he's been contrarian the whole episode, basically since he's come back to Starfleet as Section 31.
But to magnify on this scene, he's acting very bratty about the whole entire affair, and he has his little line at the end where some of us are still suffering,
meh.
And the problem is, as an actor,
I was like, yes, you are. Yes, you are. That makes sense.
I understand what his character's, where his character's coming from, and I understand performance-wise why he's approaching it like this. Because his character has this really fucked up history with the Klingon War, he's still reeling from it, and him trying to find meaning in all of this.
He recently had to give up his son.
He's trying to find meaning in all of this mess. He can't get back with Michael. He can't be a Klingon. He can't be a human. Now he's dedicating himself to Section 31. So now he's ingratiating his principles into their principles.
It could be really fascinating to see a character who's been pushed out of the black and out of the white into the gray.
And I understand all of these little nuances that are there. He's got this tragedy. When he has this line, it's like, Semaphore, this is suffering. Yes, he's suffering. But I have the same issue with Wesley Crusher in TNG. I can understand what they wanted to do with Wesley Crusher from like a writing perspective. I can understand Will Wheaton's performance choices. But there's this just undeniable wincing angst that emanates from both of those characters' performances that just annoys the fuck out of me.
Angst is the perfect word.
And when Ash Tyler's sitting there next to Pike, and I actually agreed with Ash Tyler's perspective in that conversation, but Ash Tyler's handling it, and that actor's handling it in such a little bitchy, whingy, bratty way like he did in Point of Light that I just couldn't give a shit about what Ash Tyler had to say. And I
wanted him to be wrong because I was just like, no.
But the scene says he's wrong. Yeah. And the scene says he's wrong. And that's a problem I have with Star Trek Discovery, and we're noticing this, is I hate so much how stacked debates are in this show, or disagreements. Michael, for instance, we always complain, and this episode doesn't have it, but this, which is a good thing, Michael's always right.
Yeah.
So whenever she's having a debate or conflict with anyone, you know it doesn't matter because she's always right.
She will be proven right.
In some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
And that was this scene as well, where Pike's right. Even though what Ash Tyler's saying is 100% valid, there's never enough of the ambiguity of scenes enough. There's never a moment where you might side with Pike, but you're
gonna end from the start beginning. Of a scene.
Mother. And remember how we knew from the beginning of that scene that she was going to say mother in Point of Light?
No, exactly. Because everything is so telegraphed. There is no nuance in the script or in allowed into the performances.
No.
Everything is down the line.
Yeah, and it's a bummer.
We're on those train tracks.
And it's a bummer because that scene should be one where you as the audience feel like, yeah, Pike's right, but maybe Ash has a point. But at the end of the day, even though I agreed with Ash's points at the end of the scene, I just go, oh, well, Pike's right because Ash is a little bitch. And Pike's always right. He was right this whole entire episode about everything. There was never a moment where he wasn't right. So, of course, he's right here. Even though it's frustrating because Section 31, as an organization, of course, they're antagonistic. I've watched DS9. But they operate within the gray. And here's a character who we just said falls into the gray offering up the gray, offering it up, and the writers force it to go into the black or into the white of right or wrong. And that's just so lame. It's so lame and boring. And when you watch a scene like that, there's no meat to it. There's just, oh, well, here it goes.
It could have been so much more. It could have been so much better. And instead, it's just not. It's like, this could have been like a glorious Sunday roast with all of the trimmings, but instead we've just got some lunch meat that's slapped in our faces.
And that's Ash the whole episode, because they keep treating it like, oh, that old stick in the mud Ash Tyler over there, old fuck face, what? Could you shut the fuck up, Ash? And you know what? That could have worked if...
What even are they trying to do?
I think that could have worked if you hadn't be like the whole episode, but then punch in the gut and him at the end with this scene in which all these things that he's concerned about are valid points, but he wasn't allowed to communicate them properly during the crisis. That could have been great, but instead, we don't get that. And instead, all we get is Ash Tyler is is a wuss, a shill. He's a fucking complainer, a whiner. He's a corporate stooge. He's an idiot. He's paranoid and like boo hoo hoo. And he is like, at the end of the day, whatever philosophy, whatever ideology he could have offered up to the table, like you said, just smacked off the table. You get nothing. And that was my frustration with Ash Tyler in the episode. He's not in it very much, but he could have offered something, because there is a genuine question to be asked about what the Red Angel's intentions are, and the fact that we're going on this whole, like, oh, well, it's a person, we know that. Okay, well, that means it's someone with cognitive abilities that is doing this for their own gain or their own motivations. Are we being trapped into something? And this is involving time travel. Maybe what we're doing is positive right now, but what happens if it leads to dangerous things in the future? Think back, Rachel. We recently rewatched an episode of TNG in which a time traveler from the past was pretending to be from the future. And he was alleging that he had this information about this planet that Picard had to save. And it was...
Yeah.
Picard was demanding and was wanting him to tell him the information of, if I save these lives, is that the right thing? Is that whatever? And that whole conversation there, that had ambiguity. That had a whole thing of, if I tell you one way, it will affect it. And if you save them, maybe it will erase my future and my future is great. Or if you don't, like, if they die, then that...
We don't know in this moment.
Yeah.
And this conversation is what will influence what happens.
Yeah, and the actual outcomes of either situation could be either really positive or really detrimental. And Ash Tyler could have brought that up about the Red Angel. This is something that could have really been like, is this playing us for some eviler game that we, at the moment, in the short hindsight of, ooh, Saru's people got freed, aren't knowing the full implications and the impacts that will be caused from things that this random entity is playing.
Okay,
but instead,
Ryan,
it's, Ash, you're dumb.
You're aware we're no longer at war, and we don't want to end up in one again. This last war, sir, took a toll on those who fought it. Some of us are still torn apart.
Tilly is full of faults this episode, yet she's barely in it.
Yeah, she's on the bridge and that one other set.
The research set.
Yeah, she doesn't even really have lines when she's on the bridge much. She's, like, usually
what
there
about
in
her
the background.
What about her bothered you this episode? Because you really vexing about it when we were watching it. You really, like, riled up about it every time she came on screen, her and Arium, but mainly her.
Yeah, so I feel like usual Tilly is a little bit watered down than what she was in this episode. This felt...
I mean, remember what she was like last episode where she was constantly screaming and telling terrible jokes? I think we've gone down a few levels from that one.
Yes. So, but it's still like, okay. So we encourage, we want to see some refinement in the characters, right? We want to see
some
them
dimension.
Change, evolve, but it feels like with Tilly, they've boiled off extra things, so now she's just like a condensed jam of social awkwardness and
quirky
she's nothing, funniness.
She's nothing funniness. Thus far in our watching of season two, she's been boiled down to quirks. She's no longer coming across like a relatable character, but quirks. A series of quirks manufactured into a character, not a character anymore.
Nothing about Tilly feels organic. And it is just part of the overall show also feeling more constructed, because it's like Tilly is here and she is doing this thing. This is the roll of the dice and she has been assigned this job for this scene. And she will only do this thing.
Yes.
And so it feels even less. They don't try to give her any depth. They want that one-dimensional plane of existence.
Well,
where there is no room. It's not even two dimensions. Because it is just a line. It is just one.
They do try to, but we don't like it. Like that whole scene, like with her and May, that whole thing with May freaking it out and making
I'm specifically talking about her in the scenes in this episode.
Well, this episode
More broadly, they do try and at least give her two dimensions. We'll give them that.
But this episode, she was just...
Sometimes they even try and give the illusion of three on a page. I acknowledge that they try and do that. I do not appreciate it, and I do not think that it succeeds.
Galaxy Pie.
I want to rattle off some of the smaller complaint things, because we've
Gripe time. It's been a while since gripe time.
Some of these are big, but we have some real big things I want to discuss. So let's rattle some of these off that I have been holding in. When I think of Star Trek Discovery's aesthetic, when I think of the thing I do not like about the show, it's this episode. They have so little respect for the audience when it comes to just having characters talk. They just don't trust that the audience... They think, we can't just shoot a scene in which characters talk about something. We can't just have it shot, reverse shot, or still shots, or wide shots, or anything. We have to have the camera move, we have to have lens flares, we have to have music. There's the scene in which it's Pike, Ash, and Michael talking about the Red Angel, talking about Spock, talking about all this stuff. And it is obnoxious. Amounts of spinning the camera over and over and over and over and over again. And this is the scene I always think of when I think of what I do not like about Star Trek Discovery. Not just its dialogue, not just this. When I think of what I don't like about Star Trek Discovery, this scene always pops into my brain because it is a simple scene and they feel the need to be cinematic. I think that's how they want to describe it. Oh, it's cinematic. Someone on our YouTube even said, oh, the spinning camera stuff, well, in Italian cinema, you see, that's actually quite a staple there. Look, I haven't seen a lot of Italian cinema. I've seen a lot of Asian cinema. And Asian cinema also does the spinning camera thing as well. Guess what, though? Even in Asian cinema, which I have seen, there's such a thing as using too much of it. And you can still complain about a thing that is a stylistic choice of a certain type of filmmaking being overused and being misused. This was misused.
It's not like we don't understand why they're spinning the camera. We understand the creative choice and the impact that choice is meant to have on the viewer as they are watching it. What we disagree with is the need for that decision, because we think that the script and the acting should serve the same purpose that the spinning camera is trying to achieve, and that it would be more interesting if they didn't rely on the camera technique and instead
used the
pillars of the script and the acting, but they use the crutch of those camera techniques and those post things and the CG to add the illusion of depth to their script.
An agency. Because it can't be just a scene in which people are talking. We have to spin the camera around, and since you're spinning it fast and you have the music and you have the lens flares, it makes it feel like the scene's really, really got something going on when it actually doesn't. And it's okay that it doesn't. It's okay that this isn't a scene in which something's about to blow up underneath the table. Whoa! This is just a scene of people talking. And it feels like, as we've said many times, they have no respect for the audience's intelligence and or have no faith in the audience's intelligence to absorb a scene of exposition. I get it. It's exposition. Exposition is a necessary thing. We often talk about how clunky it is and how annoying it is and how ham-fisted it is. But exposition in a story is necessary. Whether it be told visually, whether it be told via dialogue, whether it be told via music, you need it to tell a story in some way, shape, or form. You need some form of it, at least. That's okay. And they're aware that they need it. They use it a lot. But they have to film it in such a way in which it is arrogant, to say the least. And when I think of Star Trek Discovery, I think of this scene. I think of this scene just of, you have a... it is really the personification of Star Trek Discovery. You have a simple thing. You have a simple thing, and you could execute it in a way in which it's understandable. Instead, you have a simple thing, and you execute it in a way that is just nonsensical. Such as spore drive technology. That could be done really well. Why did you set this as a prequel, though? That's kind of nonsense. It's kind of stupid. Or, like, Lorca, or, like, any of the things we've talked about. We never really have a problem with the ideas. It's always the execution of those ideas, for the most part. And that's this scene. I don't have a problem with the scene. It's the execution of the scene. And it's stupid. Another gripe, Rachel, you've heard me complain on and on about over the years since this episode came out. I love the Ba'ul, but I hate the interior of their ships because it makes no sense to me. I like that they're gross and they're oily and they're black.
You praised the design.
I like the exterior
before.
Of their ships because they're black.
But what's wrong with the interior, Ryan?
They're so clean. And it doesn't make sense to me
why
they're so...
But only the drones fly around those other parts of the ship.
That's what I mean. I don't know how the interior works of the Ba'ul. Like, all their technology interior-wise. Like, do they not walk anywhere? Do they just live in the black goo? How does their technology...
Or are they all the black goo?
No, I don't know. I don't know.
Is that
I don't
like
think
a
so.
Nest?
How do
of
you shoot?
Them and they're like a hive.
And here's another issue that I have. I kind of wish that the interior looked more like the surrounding of their black goo, where they have that kind of gooey, black, sinewy type of stuff. What I'm saying is, I wish the interior was more of an organic, gooey, yucky kind of interior, because that would make more sense for them, because I just can't think of...
But that would go against the design choice of Kelpians being organic.
No, but this is like gross, evil, black, gooey, like in Alien. Say, like, where they have the black cavernous, something's off, and it would actually thematically work because the exterior is a strong metallic, we're strong, but on the inside they're weak and decrepit and just sludge that can be squashed upon. And
that would be too interesting.
What
Star
I think
Trek
is
Discovery.
I just can't. At the end of the series, they have them flying around in their Kelpians flying around in Ba'ul fighters.
You have learned to pilot a fighter.
When I see the technology on the inside, I just can't imagine the Ba'ul interacting with it. Because it's so clean and so made for human proportions. I've got a keyboard right in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine a Ba'ul interacting with it.
No.
Because of how they're designed.
Yeah, that doesn't.
And the interior of this ship, the way it's designed, it's so clean and so pristine and so nice.
Do you remember what
I don't
I
believe
said
the Ba'ul would
the
live
first
in that.
Time we watched it?
No.
I said, well, wait, they stole the technology from somebody, right?
That would...
And you were like, no.
That's
they
theirs.
They said that they designed that. And I was like, no, that doesn't make any sense. Like, why would a goo monster have a corridor and... shit like
can you
that.
Imagine can you imagine one of the Ba'ul holding a drill
what the fuck
the like, a drill made with the aesthetic of the interiors that we've been given of the interiors of their ships, the interiors of this.
Oh, it's the same logic as Palpatine just raising an army out of the ground.
He conjured those cruisers. Yes, but that's my big gripe with the Ba'ul. I love the Ba'ul, but I do wish that they embraced a more gross design of the interiors. You see, the black goo container, that's awesome, but I think that they should have gone with a more gross interior. And again, that could thematically link up even nicer with the Ba'ul, that their exteriors, that their columns, that their ships, exterior-wise, has this really striking metallic architecture, but on the inside, it's this decaying nightmare world. And that's the Ba'ul, that the exterior, they're putting up this front of being the strong, but on the inside, they're weak and gooey.
In truth, you are frail. You would be helpless without your technology.
We'll never allow the path to be repeated. No threat to the great balance will go unanswered.
Okay, so that's all fine and good, and I would consider those fairly
minor.
Those are things that could really affect your viewing experience and your connections and whether you land on the side of a yum or a yum yum. So I'm really interested, what is your big gripe then?
Well, I have several, but my big one, and this is the big picture.
The umbrella one.
This is the big picture that makes this episode hard to enjoy.
Yeah.
Is they evolve as character development instead of just having character development. Saru physically evolves.
I was never expecting them to do that. So.
But that's what they were doing. That's what they were doing with Saru. And I mentioned this last time. In one of our previous episodes, Saru as a character.
On first viewing, I was hoping for that too, and then they just...
Everything.
They just hit the button instead of taking us on the journey.
He says a line that really, really makes sense, but it also makes me upset. I'm losing the thing that defines me. And that's true, right? He's lost the ganglia, the thing that made him sense fear, and all of these things that connect with that. It's not that it's wrong that's true. To me, they traded in his character. That's how it feels. His character wasn't defined purely by the fact he had ganglia or by the fact he could sense death or that. But he was defined by several things, but a lot of it being his fear and his anxieties and his sense of worry and his trepidation.
And dealing with that as a Starfleet officer. Where he is constantly coming up against those, and that is a part of his experience and
it made him relatable.
Exploration and how he deals with overcoming those things with the limitations that his genetics impose on him.
And his societal upbringing as well.
The compulsions and indoctrinations that he has, and how he has slowly undone those things, and how those things continue to interfere with his life, even though he keeps on thinking that he's moved past it, but they come up and they play out in different scenarios, which is a really interesting thing to have your characters deal with.
Yes, and with his evolution, there's lots of drama to be mined from that, and lots of stuff you could do with his character with that. And they do it in this episode, and there's a grand big picture. He overthrows an evil alien society, and now his race, the dominant race. And that's a whole can of worms that I just don't think we have enough time to talk about. But just to briefly touch on, it is so nice of them to think that the Ba'ul will get not genocided the fuck out of by a society, by a race that has been enslaved by them for thousands of years. I think it's so optimistic of them to think that that will all work out with the people who can now shoot darts out of their heads.
Well, Ryan, what would be the comparison?
Linda, you tell me.
No, you think about it.
No.
Where would they be drawing the comparison from?
No, you go on.
No. No, you think about it. I want to see if your brain goes the same place that mine did.
Are you thinking human society?
Yes.
I don't know. We always go to Nazis.
Yes, we do. So, you know, the Jewish people.
Yes.
Experienced the Holocaust.
Yes.
And they didn't go hunt down and kill all of the Nazis.
Oh, wait a moment. What I liked about Saru, he was relatable because he wasn't perfect. yet he tries to be, as we all do. He was the principal of Starfleet, but at the same time, he wasn't a great captain when he was in charge. He is anxious. He does have fears. He does have an upbringing that is traumatic, and he wears that on his sleeve. It made him relatable. Well, we have complaints about other characters like Michael Burnham and now Tilly and Jet Reno and Paul, where they're so fucking perfect. And when they're not, it is so overboard Shakespearean level of imperfection. While Saru didn't have that. Saru's imperfections were grounded enough for me as an audience member to relate to them, as were his perfections. Now, he no longer has those imperfections. He no longer has the fear. He no longer has the things that made me relate to him. And you can make the statements that that's growth and that's development and all that, but really, to me, they physically evolved him to evolve his character. And I related to this. You know Reg Barkley?
Mm-hmm.
The character of Reg Barkley. You know what makes him relatable?
What?
All of his imperfections, all of these things that are awkward about him, all of his quirky insecurities. That's what people like about Reg. You know what people wouldn't like about Reg?
If he'd stayed that evolutionized version of himself from the episode in TNG instead of being returned to normal.
Yes, that's what it is. It's give Data the emotion chip straight away. It's the Doctor gives himself a name straight off the bat in Voyager. It's Seven of Nine is Arnica from the very beginning.
It's not like, about see, the journey, it's the just destination. About the destination.
And that's my problem.
We need to learn it.
And that's my biggest weakness of this whole entire thing of Saru gets nothing from the rest of the season onwards. The newest season, they're giving him stuff to do, but he has no... there's no hook to him anymore, to me. To me, there's nothing there to hook onto. He is just another perfect character. And if not, he's another perfect character. He's a character that doesn't get anything to do. And that's what I remember from this point on, is Saru barely gets anything to do anymore. Now he has darts in his head. He can shoot you with a perfect precision at any point. He is just perfect. And it bugs me. Because he was imperfect. He wasn't perfect. He was flawed. And it's a bummer now that he is physically evolved to a superior being. He is the apex predator now. And I have little interest in Saru after this point. I've tried. With a new season, I've tried to hook onto Saru because I like Doug Jones's performance, and he's the character that reminds me of Star Trek characters. But he is Reg if he stayed perfect. He is Data if he got the emotion chip straight away. He is Data if Q gave him a sense of humor the whole time instead of just for a flickering moment. He is Spock if Spock was fully embraced his humanity from them. But you know what I'm saying? You said it. It's the journey, not necessarily 100% the destination.
You know, there's a transition I went through in season two where I broke free from that. So now that's been liberating, and he now can be in a position of leadership confidently. That changes everything.
Hugh time.
It's time for the Hugh time. So I will now we'll start off. I'll introduce the main scene with Hugh in it. I think it's the only
he was
one.
Oh, he was in two scenes, but they were in the same room.
Yeah. So we have two main moments. One where he is the scar was the one that I was going to go
with. Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Because that's first, isn't it?
I thought we start out with him and Saru and then go to the scar. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
It's two scenes.
So we get the story behind a scar that he no longer has because he was reconstituted from his DNA and... his DNA didn't have the scar.
We never saw the
scar.
The scar
was why he became, well, a reminder of why he became a doctor.
We never saw the scar, right?
I don't think so.
Which is cool. because you can just make it up wherever you want. You don't need to have set it up. You can just say he had one there, he no longer does, and now that's impactful.
It was just always covered by his singlet, because we don't really see him fully shirtless. He's always wearing a singlet or a full top, so.
Yeah, I don't even remember in the first season seeing him in a singlet. It was always kind of like a top. What bugs me about the scar scene is it's not a Hugh scene. It's about Hugh, but Hugh doesn't get to, like...
He has no agency.
Well...
He's being talked about and to, but he is not showing who he is.
Well, he's traumatized.
Other than the fact that he's uncomfortable, I guess.
Well, that's the actual focus of the scene. All the information that Paul's saying is just the information to have in the background to be droned out by the sound that TV and movies like to have for when people are drifting off or having traumatic events happening. The high-pitched noise, you know the one. Like when a bomb just goes off and your ears are ringing. The scene is actually focusing on is something's not right with Hugh. He's not feeling
that
right.
That noise also plays into the fact that they're saying that like his nervous system is out of whack and too overreactive, I guess.
It'll be right. And then the other scene is between him and Saru, and him and Saru just kind of chat about, yeah, I've gone through a big life thing, so have you. We'll move past it. We'll move with it. It'll
Whatever.
Be fine.
Okay, so you want to hear the line that I picked out from...
Yes.
Perhaps. Perhaps.
Perhaps. Da-da-da-da-da.
In feeling less like you were, you are more like who you were meant to become.
And the problem with that is we never really got to know who Hugh was. And that's his whole story's major issue.
But we know who Saru is.
Yeah,
Saru was talking more about himself than about Hugh, even though he's talking to Hugh and meant to be giving him advice. But it doesn't make any sense to us because we don't know anything about him that's important, and that he's shown us. We've been told various things and various inconsequential things to who he is now.
Even in this same episode, he had a scar. This inspired him to be a doctor. Da, 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 da. We should have known who Hugh was as a character so that this storyline for this
but
season...
But they didn't think that we would care.
They didn't think that we would be invested in the relationship drama that's going to be happening, right? But this is the crux of this episode and the storyline that they're setting up with him, which is he has an existential crisis about who he is. What's great about having an existential crisis in one of your main characters in your show, as someone who's going to have a season-long arc about it, is we should have had an understanding of who that character was before they had the existential crisis. We should have an understanding of who they were to understand what's wrong.
Oh, we haven't got time for that.
But they never dedicated the time to giving Hugh anything to
work
with.
Nah, we haven't got time for that, Ryan.
So this whole season-long story, this episode story of seeing Hugh whinge and complain and blah, 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 and now season 3's on the table, in which he's now settled into being a character a bit more, it makes this whole entire journey feel like a detour and a pointless one at that, even though there's interesting things in there which we'll talk about.
We're meant to be devastated.
Talking about devastation, would you rate this episode a yum or a yum yum?
Yum.
I rate it a...
See, I was just like, it almost is enough for a yum yum. Mm. But because I know that it gets worse, and this one didn't make me particularly angry, which is a prime one of my criteria for giving something a yum. But I think I mainly do end up giving it the yum because of the legacy of what this episode does.
That's where I land. I give this a yum. It basically killed Saru's interest for me. It killed my interest in that character. It derailed it. It ruined
Speaking
the journey.
Speaking of derailing characters.
But hold on. I also give it a yum yum because Giorgio wasn't in this episode, and it felt fucking great not having her. Talking about having Giorgio in an episode, next week we are going to be discussing episode 7 of Star Trek Discovery called Light and Shadows, the plot of which, according to IMDb, goes as such. Burnham goes to Vulcan in search of Spock, where she unearths surprising family secrets. In researching what is left of the Red Angel signal over Kamina, Pike and Tyler end up in a battle with time itself. Giorgio has Giorgio has a few tricks up her sleeve for Leland and Section 31.
Antics ensue.
I'm sure she'll say AI sausage or make fun of his bald head. So Light and Shadows.
I didn't appreciate my interjections.
I did. I just really wanted to stop talking about the next episode because I already know that I don't like this one. Or do I?
Ooh. We have as much ambiguity as Star Trek Discovery.
Or do we? Ooh. Mystery Box.
Mystery Box.
A pleasure, as always, Rachel, to be talking about Star Trek Discovery with you. Even if episodes like this are big, meaty boys. I mean, there's so much other stuff we just didn't have time to talk about because this episode is jam-packed, full of stuff. But here we are at the end of the episode, in which we tell you to rate and review us on whatever podcatcher allows it. Follow us on all of those social medias, you know, the Facebook, the Twitter, the Instagram, the Reddit. All of this is in the description of this episode. And you can email us at
yumyumpod@gmail.com.
Also, as mentioned earlier in the episode, and as mentioned in many episodes, we have a Patreon in which we talk about the Star Trek movies. We also talk about the bottom 5 and the top 5 rated Star Trek episodes of other series, and we give our thoughts on other television shows. As mentioned, we have talked about Babylon 5, we've talked about Misfits, we've talked about Doctor Who, we've talked about Sherlock. We've got a whole plethora of content on our Patreon. Just look up Yum Yum Podcast on Patreon, and all of that, again, in the description of this episode. So, Rachel, I think the only way to end this episode is with a nice, big, juicy, wet slice of galaxy pie.